65 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid 60s. From the recording library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the recording library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. Each week, recording library volunteers and staff dig into past editions of the National Magazine of Texas.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's program. Our show for the next 2 weeks will focus on a Texan who made her mark as a Grammy Award-winning singer, songwriter, spokesperson, businesswoman, model, actress, and fashion designer. Selena would have turned 50 on April 16th, 2021. This show will involve something we've never done before. Instead of articles that are at least 20 years old, the stories in this hour are from the April 2021 current issue of Texas Monthly, which features Selena on the cover. The theme of the magazine is Selena at 50. The writers of these stories, who were gathered by Texas Monthly to celebrate her, are part of a generation of Latinos who came of age after her heyday. They touch on many facets of how her life continues to inspire and influence those who were not even born at the time of her death. We will also look back to TM's archives in next week's program to read articles written about her during the 1990s. This hour's articles are being read by Linda.
Selena at 50, celebrating the life, art, and influence of a Tejano legend. Kacey Musgraves ascended the star-shaped stage at NRG Stadium, where the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo convenes every year. Bathed in purple light, the East Texas-bred country musician began a song her audience likely wasn't expecting. A twangy take on Selena's smash hit, Como la Flor. Watching the performance on YouTube, the viewer can barely distinguish Musgraves' voice from those of thousands of ebullient fans scream-singing along to the chorus, Ay, y como me duele. Musgraves' homage on February 25th, 2019, held a bittersweet significance. Almost exactly 24 years earlier, on February 26, 1995, Selena had performed at the rodeo in what would be her last televised concert before her death a month later. Famously, Selena had kicked off her sold-out Astrodome show with a genre move that was every bit as audacious as Musgraves'. Rather than open with one of her cumbia-imbued hits, she launched into a disco medley, blitzing through the likes of I Will Survive, Funky Town, and Last Dance. If any of Selena's 61,000 fans in attendance were disappointed, it's impossible to tell from their impassioned response preserved in the YouTube video of the medley, which has been viewed more than 38 million times. At her peak, Selena could do things no other Tejano artist dared to, and her audience followed along rapturously. The Astrodome show stands as a testament to how popular and potent a cultural figure Selena Quintanilla Perez was, and still is today. In late February, the streaming service Spotify said that more than 5 million listeners had played her songs over the previous 4 weeks. By contrast, her fellow late Texan, Janis Joplin, drew roughly 4 million visitors. Just 2 years ago, Selena's 1990 album, Ven Conmigo, the first Tejano record by a female artist to go gold, was inducted into the Library of Congress National Recording Registry. an honor bestowed on recordings deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Selena would have turned 50 this April 16th, and as the stories in this commemorative package demonstrate, her enduring legacy extends far beyond her songs. The Lake Jackson-born, Corpus Christi-raised musician served as a role model for a generation, and counting, of young Latinas trying to make their way in a fraught, multicultural society. Selena, role model, page 70. Her strides in fashion design at once celebrated and subverted her Tejano roots, expanding our sense of what it could mean to be a Latina in the limelight. Selena Fashionista, page 80. Her conflicts with her conservative-minded family resonated with many queer fans. For queer Tejanos in particular, she's regarded as a heroine, much as Judy Garland served as an idol for earlier generations of gay men. Selena, gay icon, page 76. And of course, there's the music, which continues to inspire everyone from Tejano bands to punk rockers. Selena, Queen of Tejano, page 72. Perhaps the greatest testimony to Selena's legacy is that, on what would have been her 50th birthday, the writers we've gathered to celebrate her are part of a generation of Latinos who came of age after her heyday. A couple of them hadn't even been born before she died. Yet their devotion is as strong as that of anyone who stood and shouted with joy all those years ago in the Astrodome. Paula Mejia. Selena, role model. A quarter century after her death, countless young Latinas regard the late musician as an icon. Maybe it's time we took her off the pedestal. By Kat Cardenas. In the days following my grandpa's death in 2019, I searched his house for old photographs. My family was putting together a slideshow to play at his funeral, and I wanted to find pictures that would remind attendees of the incredible life he had lived. Snapshots of him posing with the lions and hippos he cared for at the San Antonio Zoo, training polo ponies in Tennessee, and relaxing at his parents' home back in Mexico. In an old dresser at the back of the house, I stumbled upon a worn leather book filled with photos, a handful of which fell to the floor when I opened it up, the adhesive long since dried out. I found myself gazing at images of two family dogs, Shakira and Spudsy, that were long gone, and of my cousins riding horseback at my grandpa's ranch. And then, toward the back of the album, I came across clippings from People and the San Antonio Express News, all of them featuring Selena, all dated from the days and weeks after her death. In practically every shot, she had a microphone in hand, and her dazzling smile lit up the page. Thousands of fans mourn Selena, read one headline. Tejano artist's potential to remain unrealized, read another. Drowning in waves of despair over my grandpa's death, I was desperate for a distraction. So I sat there at his kitchen table and pored over those stories. I recognized the grief in the faces of young fans sobbing by the chain link fence that surrounded Selena's Corpus Christi home and clutching the black marble bench at her gravesite. Studying these images of mourning felt strangely comforting. My grandpa's death was a loss so profound that I wasn't sure I would ever recover. But those forgotten articles, by then more than two decades old, made clear to me that there is life after death and power in remembering. And for what felt like the thousandth time, Selena had found me right where I needed her. In Mexican families, the dead never die. Long after our friends and relations have passed on, we will them back into existence by telling their stories, by transforming their lives into folklore, and by building altars to their memories so that their spirits remain with us. I was born in 1996, a year after Selena's death and a year into her sainthood. I don't remember who first told me about her or when I listened to her music for the first time, but it felt like she was always there, playing in the background, while my family members and I browsed the aisles of the Handy Andy supermarket and during drives with my tías and tíos. For a few years, I had no idea where she was from or what had happened to her. I just knew she felt familiar. There's a scene in Lourdes Portillo's 1999 documentary, Corpus, a home movie for Selena, in which she homes in on a group of young girls studying at the Tejano Academy of Fine Arts in Corpus Christi. One student wears a crop top along with a slicked back bun and a hint of red lipstick, resembling a miniature Selena. Around her, about a dozen other Latinas with long, dark hair take turns hopping on the stage, singing in English and Spanish while they twirl around the room. They sometimes lock eyes with Portillo's lens, confidently attempting to attack each note with the same passion and power for which Selena was known. The scene was filmed around 1998, just 3 years after the musician's death. Watching it today, it's striking how little has changed. Portillo has yet to see a celebrity speak to Latinos in quite the same way. There have been other Latina singers and stars, but no one with the magnitude and charisma she had, Portillo tells me. She had a tenderness that made girls see themselves in her. They saw the possibility of being Selena. At Las Palmas Elementary on the west side of San Antonio, my classmates and I often swapped rumors and stories about Selena, piecing together what had happened to her from whispered conversations we overheard at home about her violent death. By the fourth grade, we knew the basics. Selena was a shining light, a once-in-a-lifetime talent, and one of us. She was a girl from the barrio, from South Texas, where she and her siblings had started a band together. She sang in English and Spanish and danced around the stage in marvelous glittering outfits. She was the Mexican Madonna. She was La Reina. She was on the verge of accomplishing things that no other Mexican-American singer ever had. And then she was killed, taken from the people who loved her by one of her biggest fans. Her ascendance didn't happen in a vacuum. Throughout the 90s and early aughts, an increase in illegal immigration prompted waves of anti-Latino sentiment and anti-immigrant legislation across the country. Those attitudes served as the backdrop for Selena's rise to fame and amplified the grief following her loss. In her 2009 book, Selena Dodd, Selena, Latinos, and the Performance of Memory, the San Antonio-born cultural critic Deborah Paredes explores Selena's impact on Latino communities. Even as Latinos mourned her tragedy, they represented possibility, Paredes says. The hope that perhaps things would get better for Latinos. But in the sixth grade, my family moved to Fair Oaks Ranch on the outskirts of San Antonio, and I learned that the connection I'd felt to Selena wasn't universal. I went from a majority Hispanic city to a suburb where Hispanic residents made up little more than 10% of the population. From the first day of school, I was made keenly aware of my ethnicity. Teachers and students stumbled over my last name. The normalcy of my family suddenly seemed abnormal. While my classmates might have visited a few of their relatives over summer break, my immediate family consisted of at least 20 people, aunts, uncles, and cousins, who all lived within a 30-mile radius of each other and saw one another every week. And I was sure that my grandpa's signature dishes, especially his menudo, would have been enough to scare off most of my peers. I felt lost. Around that time, YouTube was becoming more popular. For the first time, I could watch compilations of Selena's legendary performances online whenever I wanted to, and could listen to her goof around in behind-the-scenes footage and talk show interviews. In one snippet, captured between takes for the video of No Me Queda Más, she sassily introduces the director, Sean Roberts. "Little does he know, I call the shots," she says with a cheeky grin, explaining that production had temporarily come to a halt in order to find one of her treasured white roses, an example of how every little detail had to match her vision. In another video from her 1995 performance of Baila Esta Cumbia at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, her dancing is relentless. She makes ample use of her hips, spinning back and forth under the spotlight while executing flamenco-inspired gestures with her hands. I was in love with the way that she moved, acutely aware of my own awkwardness and envious of the command she had over her body. And when I listened to her talk, she sounded like one of my friends from San Antonio. Throughout my suburban exile, Selena was my life raft. I clung to her for support when it felt as though I was losing touch with myself. I spent 6 days of the week in Fair Oaks Ranch, where I learned the lyrics to Taylor Swift and Paramore songs, and grew deeply invested in the drama between Nick Jonas, Miley Cyrus, and Selena Gomez. But on Sundays, I returned to San Antonio's west side, where my aunts and uncles gently teased me and said I was forgetting my Spanish. During my junior year of high school, when I enrolled in advanced Spanish, something changed. I finally met friends who didn't need my help conjugating verbs, who knew Selena's entire discography, and introduced me to songs of hers I'd never heard. On a break, our teacher let us walk around outside, and I heard El Chico del Apartamento 512 and Tus Deprecios for the first time, trying to get my mouth to form the words as quickly as Selena's did. Selena has a way of making you feel seen, but also of feeling so completely out of your league that you want to figure out how to be her. She became my teacher. I practiced her songs in choir rooms, learning new Spanish words. I was particularly captivated by her performance at Fiesta Broadway in 1992, where she demonstrated how fluent she had become at Janet Jackson and Paula Abdul style footwork. I spent months trying to learn her moves, dances I would never have asked someone to teach me. Occasionally, I shared her songs with my non-Latino friends, convinced that I was going to open up a whole new world to them, only to be told that they just didn't get it. When I went to college in Austin and was away from my family for the first time, Selena's voice was again a guiding presence that pushed me to go for bolder looks, to wear red lipstick, to put on hoop earrings, to seek out attention, and not be afraid if someone gave it to me. Texas capital city had more Latinos than Fair Oaks Ranch, but it still wasn't San Antonio. During my first few years there, I'd get in my car and drive around town, blasting Serena's greatest hits as I scoured East and South Austin for panaderias and fruterias. With each drive, the city felt a little bit more like home. In that leather scrapbook in my grandpa's house, I encountered a folded page from the Sunday, April 2nd, 1995 edition of the Express News. As I carefully peeled it out, a headline caught my eye. Neighbors saw role model in girl from Molina. Selena's power stemmed from the fact that she was a real person. All of her otherworldly talent was wrapped up in a human being. She practiced, she worked, she grew frustrated with record label decisions and the delay of her English crossover album. In the days after her death, as reporters walked through the working class streets of Molina, they came to understand why there were lines of cars filled with people who had driven hours to leave mementos outside of her house. Her star had been on the rise for years, but she had stayed in the neighborhood, recruiting kids to help with yard work or to track down her dog when it got loose. Between gigs, she made appearances at local schools, encouraging young fans to stay focused on their studies. She was still a Molina girl, said Corpus Christi High School principal Danny Noyola, somebody who doesn't forget where they come from. When I was a child, 23 seemed well on the far side of adulthood. I imagined it as the age when you got married, bought a house, and maybe started a family. Selena's death at 23 was heartbreaking, but I felt sure that she had gotten a taste of freedom, a brief chance to live before her life was cut short. Now that I'm 24, Selena at 23 feels impossibly young, too young to have the pressure of international stardom on her shoulders, too young to think about what she had to give up to achieve it, too young to be turned into a martyr. Yet she became one, or whatever other label of reverence you might want to put on her, a saint, a queen, a symbol, a role model. Coming along as I did after her death, I've only ever known her as an icon, something bigger than herself. That's understandable given that she died so early in her career and with so much of her story unfinished. It's no wonder that those of us who were devoted to her filled those gaps with our adoration. But the problem with sainthood is that it has made the real Selena less tangible. In the early 90s, Selena was doing something radical. She wasn't sacrificing the imperfect or less commodifiable parts of herself to rise through the ranks. She was putting them on full display for everyone to see. She embraced her Mexican heritage at a time when Latinos were under pressure to assimilate. She didn't hide from her fans on the other side of the border that her Spanish was far from perfect. She designed outfits that showed off her curves and challenged mainstream standards of beauty. Last year, when Selena, the series, premiered on Netflix, fans expressed outrage at the portrayal of a meek young woman who sat back as her brother, A.B., and her father, Abraham, made decisions for her. It ran counter to everything so many Latinas had come to love about Selena. She wasn't just a singer or a fashion icon. She was an enterprising woman making her way in a culture that was, and is still, dominated by men. In that sense, maybe she was a saint, because saints aren't usually passive or peaceable. They're fierce to their cores. While most of us recognize Selena's tenacity, though, that halo we've placed above her head has turned her into an infallible figure she never pretended to be. To truly understand what was lost when Selena died, new generations of fans need to see her as a person, not a myth. Selena left us when she was still inventing herself, when she hadn't made any major missteps. She's forever frozen in amber on the precipice of superstardom, having rarely, if ever, failed at anything. But if we're going to honor Selena, the real Selena, and find a way to carry her with us as we move through our own lives, then we need to imagine what she might have done if she had lived a full one. That, too, is a way of ensuring the dead never die. She would have doubtless gone on to greater heights. She might have become an actress or a heavy hitter in the international fashion world. She might have headlined a Super Bowl halftime show. In a bid for relevancy later in her career, she might have also released a trap album, or recorded a duet with Adam Levine, or appeared in Gal Gadot's Imagine video. Because she was human, she would have inevitably made some mistakes, and that would have forced us into a more nuanced and complicated relationship with her. In this, I'm reminded of my grandpa. Though I see in him many of the same things I see in Selena, a resolute will to succeed against the odds, abiding loyalty to his family, and pride in his roots on both sides of the border, he was also completely unlike her. He lived to be 89 years old, and when I think of him, it's not just of the heroic younger years I heard so many stories about, but of the decades that followed, the years I witnessed. I saw him experience grief and frailty. I watched his temper flare. I saw his pride cloud his judgment. As much as I loved him, I know that he sometimes let his loved ones down. Selena never got the chance to disappoint us, but if she had lived long enough, she surely would have, and we would have had to struggle to love her, which is a different kind of love, and maybe a better one. Selena, Queen of Tejano and Punk Rock, by Paul Mejia. La Reina's spirit lives on among a new era of Texas musicians, whether they pluck a bajo sexto or shred on a Stratocaster. Though Selena has been gone for nearly three decades, her music is as alive as ever. She has spurred dead ringer impersonators and tribute bands such as Austin's Bidi Bidi Banda. Even acts that stand well outside of the world of Tejano are eager to spread her magic. The pop star Camila Cabello performed a faithful cover of Dreaming of You at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo 2 years ago. The Houston rapper Fat Tony has nodded to Selena in his lyrics. And until it broke up in 2018, the great San Antonio punk band Girl in a Coma often played a blistering rendition of Si Una Vez. To illuminate how deeply Selena has influenced contemporary Texas music, senior editor Paula Mejia sat down with four songwriters, Jen Alva and Fonny Diaz of the San Antonio punk band Fea. Both were formerly members of Girl in a Coma, Bidi Bidi Banda frontwoman Stephanie Bergara, and Tejano and Conjunto artist and music archivist Veronique Medrano for a Zoom roundtable. Paula Mejia, how did Selena's life and music influence your trajectory as an artist? Veronique Medrano, I had already been in the industry for 4 or 5 years when I was given the opportunity to enter some of my memorabilia into the Whitliff collections at Texas State University. The Whitliff had photos from Selena's tours that no one had ever seen, thanks to Ramon Hernandez, a Tejano historian from San Antonio, who had followed her career for years. I always felt like when you see Selena, you see the image of La Santa, the saint. But when you see the photos from behind the scenes, she's sleeping on the floor of a bus, laughs. She's just like every one of us who struggles and fights to be heard, who puts in the work. A lot of us women go through these things quietly. We put on the smile, we put on the lipstick, we put on the face. But quietly, in the back, we're dealing with the struggles. We are dealing with misogyny. So seeing those photos endeared her to me in a totally different sense. That's what showed me, as an archivist, how important it is to show the reality of being a musician, of living this life. It's what inspired me to go into archival work full-time at the university level and get that degree that says, I'm not just Mexicana, I'm educated on this, and you will listen to me. Because there aren't a lot of brown archivists. There aren't enough of us preserving our history. Fanny Diaz, I think the reason we relate to Serena so much and why Girl in a Coma covered Si Una Vez is her upbringing. She was very humble, she worked really hard, and she always remained true. And that's something that we always strove to do, to represent our hometown, to be proud of where we're from. Jen Alva, when you see Selena sing Si Una Vez live, she's got this pure attitude in her face. Diaz, punk rock. Alva, it was a no-brainer when we chose that song. We love dynamics in a song. It's like a telenovela. It's dramatic all of a sudden, and it was slow just a second ago. Stephanie Bergara, Selena inspired me to make my own way. A year into doing Bidi Bidi Banda, this is pre-baby, smaller, cuter, younger me, I was hand-sewing rhinestones onto these costumes, making exact replicas of Selena costumes, and it was killing me. I dreaded doing it. And a year into it, I was like, I hope that if Selena were still around, she would want me to make my own way. So one afternoon, we were playing a show in August in Texas. It was 113 degrees outside. And I was like, I'm not gonna do it. My hair was bleached blonde. I would put it up in a bun and hairspray it black so I would look as much like her as I possibly could. That day, I decided not to. And it really changed the dynamic of our band and what we do. It changed our branding. It changed the way people saw us and wanted to consume the music. And the music, not our imitation of Selena and her band, ended up becoming the primary function of what we do. It was the best decision I made in terms of the band, to make my own way. Mejia. As a Mexican-American in Texas, Selena grew up writing songs in English and not speaking Spanish. She eventually learned to sing it phonetically. She showed that you could be proud of dual, and often dueling, identities, which is meaningful given that many of us have complicated relationships to the Spanish language. Diaz, absolutely. We're taught by our parents that it's wrong, that if you speak Spanish, you might not get further. Alva, when I was growing up, my parents spoke Spanish right in front of me, but they didn't include me. They didn't teach me. It's almost like they feel that speaking Spanish, and anything related to being Mexican-American, is gonna hold you back. Medrano, I was very intimidated by songwriting when I started. The rule for songwriting for Tejano, Conjunto, Norteño was that you had to write in Spanish. And a lot of these rules were made by men in the industry. There's a very small pool of women writers in the Tejano music industry. The industry is very difficult. It is not for the faint of heart. It's for las chingonas, badasses. If you're not one, go find another genre. Because there is no pity for anyone in this genre. My brain thinks in English, but goes between both. I eventually got to a place where I felt confident about writing in English, and writing songs my way. There were songs where I wrote one verse in English, and the whole chorus and melody line and pre-chorus were in Spanish, like La Pulga, Lotería, and Hola y Adiós. 75% of the songs I've written were written in English, and then I translated them. When Selena was starting out singing in English, it wasn't acceptable. It was still like, well, if you're Tejano, you sing in Spanish. We don't need the English aspect of it. Yet she's American. One thing that's ingrained in my spirit is Edward James Olmos, who played Selena's father in the biopic Selena, saying, we have to be more Mexican than the Mexicans and more American than the Americans, both at the same time. It's exhausting. Bergara, I have little tears welling up in my eyes because you're 100% correct. Just like Selena, I don't speak Spanish. I had to learn her songs phonetically. When my mom and I would listen to songs in the car on the way to the grocery, she had to translate them for me. I didn't know what these songs meant until someone was explaining them. Medrano. When I was between labels, I covered Freddie Fender's 1975 bilingual version of wasted days, and wasted nights. And I was advised vehemently, do not put this out. Nobody wants to hear a bilingual song. And I'm going to tell you right now, it's one of my top streamed songs. I had to believe in myself. I had to believe in that vision. But we have to acknowledge the start of it. And that was Selena. Alva. To go back to what Veronique was saying about that quote in the movie, where you have to be Mexican over here, American over here. In that cartoon show, Big Mouth, there's an episode where there's a black character, and he's got a dial on his arm. He dials it up like, do I have to be more black, or... And you realize, oh my God, code switching is in everything. For me, being a lesbian, how feminine do I have to be? How do I present myself? Do I just act like me? Medrano. Selena was the code switch queen. Vergara. I was the first Latina to play blues on the Green, which is a series of 20,000 person concerts that happens every summer in Zilker Park, where Austin City Limits takes place. I'm an industry professional who knows all these bookers. They'll call me, I'll sign a contract, I'll show up, I won't be a diva. And I had to question, did all these things happen because I'm a good performer? Or did they happen because I was the most accessible, safest Latina they know who would show up to work? One of the things that we're doing in 2021 is incorporating a diversity clause into our contract that's basically saying, I'll come to your club and I'll play your show. I'll play your festival. But I need to know that you have diverse booking processes throughout the year. I will not be the brown band that you book on Cinco de Mayo and 16 de Septiembre, and then you call it a day. So if you book me, you better come correct, because I'm going to be checking your booking calendar. We really want to use this platform for good and to make sure that the door stays open. Diaz, Selena opened the door, and we gotta keep doing that. Alva, any young girls that come to our shows, they're watching us. Vergara, Jen and Fanny have let my band play at the Bang Bang Bar, where they both work, on Fiesta Oyster Bake weekend, which is a huge weekend in San Antonio. And that is not a traditional space for us to play. Bitty Bitty Banda usually plays at clubs. It's our responsibility to each other and to the continuation of this effort to do that. Because if we don't have each other's backs, we continue to set this narrative that there's one seat at the table and we have to fight to the death for it. Instead of making more seats at the table, we're just going to end up taking ourselves out. All of us here are coming from different genres. There's a melting pot of music. That's what Selena was. We owe it to Selena to be a squad, to keep the squad intact. Mejia, what is something Selena doesn't get enough credit for? Vergara, she didn't finish school in the traditional way, but she really invested deeply in making sure that young people got an education and that they were taking it very seriously. She really valued that down to her business practices. And she did all these videos in the 90s, the stay in school videos. They're so cute. Diaz, I think people are starting to recognize that. It's starting to pop out, this appreciation of how humble she was. Vergara, you wanted to be friends with her. She looked like my cousin who I meet at Whataburger at 2 o'clock in the morning. She was so personable. Medrano, one of the things I think she didn't get enough credit for while she was alive was being active in the historical education of what Tejano music was and is. There are videos that she did, these PSAs about Tejano, about Mexican music, that are so important. The impact was there. You started to see more investment in the Mexican, Latinx identity. You can imagine that she would have kept it going until this day, acknowledging the ones that came before her and the ones who are coming up. I've heard story after story after story of artists who were around at that time talking about how supportive she was of the community. And it wasn't just that she was trying to get a photo op. She was doing it genuinely, from herself. I think that's something she doesn't get enough credit for, the amount of unity that she inspired and created in the 80s and 90s in the Tejano music industry and the Latin music industry. Without her, we would not be where we are today. There would not have been a people en español. That's what inspired me to do tours at public schools prior to COVID-19. I'd go and talk about the importance of education and being a musician. They would be so happy. It was just that moment when you realize these kids, they want to see themselves in the music and the videos and the things they ingest. When it's in front of them, they feel that energy. Mejia, what Selena song gets you every time? Diaz, it's still Si Una Vez. It reminds me of the time in our career when we did that. It reminds me of hard work. Alva, No Me Queda Más. I love that song because of my mom. She cherished Selena like hardcore. I still have some of her Selena magazines. Vergara. At my grandma's house, if you walk in on the mantle, there's a picture of Jesus and there's a picture of Selena. I will also choose No Me Queda Más. That's my favorite Selena song to perform and play. It's a story about a person who is just in love in this place that someone is saying doesn't exist. It's an incredibly sad and beautiful song, and the gossip on that, I think, was that Ricky Vela, Selena's keyboard player, wrote it about Suzette, Selena's sister, because he was so in love with her. The song is so special to me, and no matter where I play it, anywhere in the world, it is just gut-wrenching. Someone is always crying. Sometimes it's me. Medrano. Tus Deprecios. It's not a love song. It's, you're annoying me, get out of my face. I really enjoyed the songs where she did that, where she seems like she was mad at somebody. Those were interesting because we could see a little bit more of her, not just the bright, bubbly cumbia version of her that people idolize. You saw a bit more of a growl. So that was a song I had to do in my shows. I know a lot of people would expect Como La Flor or Bidi Bidi Bom Bom. That's not me. I don't feel like I could interpret those the way people want. That's why I always gravitated to Tus Desprecios. I felt a little necia, naughty. Mejia, it's staggering to think of how much she achieved in her brief life. Vergara. She passed away when she was about 10 years younger than me. At 23, I had ruined my life like 6 times already. I was a little idiot at 23. To see those things this young woman was doing was just fascinating. Alva, you forget how young she is, right? She was just so big, bigger than anything. Medrano, and the music that she did, the way that she interpreted it, made you feel like there was so much experience behind those songs and behind that voice. She feels, as many say, like an old soul. Vergara, it would take 3 of me to do what she did, the singing and dancing and being funny and personable. None of us are worthy. Medrano, the music industry for some reason likes to pit us against a ghost. They want to pit us against Selena as if that is ever going to happen. The next this, the next that. And that's the one thing I've done with my time in the industry. I stuck to that. No, you're not going to pit me against a ghost, especially someone that big. It's not fair to the genre or my legacy or the legacy of the woman you're trying to put me up against. the music isn't the same. I represent a different woman. As time goes on, we can remember her. We can commemorate her. But for the Tejano industry to be what it needs to be, we need to stop venerating and pitting these beautiful, beautiful women against a ghost. We're not Ghostbusters. Bergara, how do you compete with a memory? How are we supposed to compete with this person who's no longer here and honestly would not want us to be competing against each other at all? I think there needs to be space for Veronique and Fea and Bidi Bidi Banda to be on the same lineup. I think what we're all trying to say is that Selena was a real one. She was a genuinely nice person, which makes it harder to accept what happened to her. I'm in a place where I'm in receipt of all this Selena information. I listen to podcasts, all that. If you hear her on the phone talking to her staff, leaving voicemails for people, she was generally considerate of the people around her. There are no stories about Selena being competitive or ugly or catty or not talking to people. You can't find them because they don't exist. If they existed, I would know, and they're not out there. Medrano. A lot of women feel so connected to her, especially female musicians. And when they say, "Oh, I was inspired by her," they're not trying to emulate her. They're not saying they want to be the next Selena. There is no next Selena. She gave us the seed to say, we can do more. This discussion has been edited for clarity and length. Data mining. Scores of fans around the world streamed Selena's music via Spotify in 2020, specifically 11 million minutes of it. Texas currently ranks second among U.S. states for the most Selena plays. California nabbed first place, with Illinois, Florida, and New York rounding out the top five. Globally, her biggest markets on Spotify are Mexico City, Guadalajara, and Santiago, Chile, where 580,000, 214,000, and 148,000 listeners have streamed her songs, respectively. S.J. Selena, gay icon. Why queer Texans see a version of themselves brilliantly transfigured in the late musician, by Joe Galvan. On a humid, warm night in the spring of 2008 at a party in McAllen, I met the man who would become my first boyfriend. After staring at me all evening from across the room, he finally walked up, introduced himself, and asked who I knew there. "Hardly anyone," I said. "Good," he replied. "I don't know anyone either. Do you want to get out of here?" "Where did you want to go?" I asked. He shrugged and said, "Let's go to Whataburger." The breeze blew weakly through palm trees as we drove. We ordered double Whataburgers in the drive-thru, then settled into the garish-lit parking lot to eat. Hundreds of moths fluttered around the lights, reminding me of the Friday night football games I used to watch in my hometown of Harlingen. As we ate in silence, too nervous to look at one another, he played the only Selena album that he was familiar with at the time, her fifth, Dreaming of You, on the car stereo. Later that night, after we went to his condo on South Padre Island, ostensibly to walk along the beach, I held his hand while humming the bridge to the album's title track. When we shared our first kiss later that evening, "I'm Getting Used to You" swayed gently in the background. It's not unusual for South Texas queers to have tender, personal Selena stories. In the years since her death, she has become a gay icon, especially in Texas and especially among queer Tejanos. But how is it that a Jehovah's Witness from Lake Jackson, who never, to my knowledge, expressed explicit support for her gay fans, has come to occupy such an important place in many of their lives. A big part of this stems from Selena's life story. Her family, like so many Mexican-American families in South Texas, was culturally conservative. Though her father, Abraham, pushed her into music, Selena was, for years, strictly reined in. She and her siblings practiced long hours with the family band, Selena y los Niños, leaving her little time to interact with children her age. As she once told Tejano historian Ramon Hernandez, well into her teenage years, she had neither gone on a date nor attended a football game. Dancing with someone outside of her circle was out of the question, too. "I don't dance with strangers unless they ask my dad for permission," she said. But as Selena came of age, Abraham's desire to protect her from the world clashed with her growing independence. Abraham may not have liked the provocative stage outfits she designed for herself, but it was her secret romance with her bandmate, Chris Perez, that really set him off. When he discovered their relationship, he forced them apart. This story is well known to Selena's admirers, but the tale carries a twinge of pain for queer fans of her music. They understand the peril of being found out by their families, the ache of not being able to hold their boyfriend's hand at a barbecue, or of having that boyfriend introduced to relatives as just a friend. Selena immortalized the concept of forbidden love in one of her most popular tunes, Amor Prohibido. But there's inspiration here, too. After Abraham ended their affair, Selena and Perez eloped, a metaphor for the liberation that so many gay people have sought. She almost seemed to be telling us, it gets better. And there were undoubtedly queer aspects of Selena's music and style, the bold movements and maximum attitude that are the hallmarks of voguing, a performance style largely pioneered by Black and Latino members of New York City's LGBTQ community in the 80s, showed up in Selena's choreography. This is no surprise, given that one of Selena's heroes, Madonna, had already brought voguing to the mainstream. In a 1994 performance on the Mexican morning show Un Nuevo Día that can be viewed online, Selena sings Bidi Bidi Bom Bom while spinning, then places a hand on her hip and strikes a pose, a move that wouldn't have been out of place in a Manhattan nightclub. In another clip of Si Una Vez, she hits a high note and brings her hand up to gesture toward her face, eyes wide. Selena also loved disco, a genre of 70s music inextricable from gay nightlife, and hated by many precisely because of that association. Further than Chicago's infamous 1979 disco demolition night, this affection is especially apparent in Is It the Beat?, a song she recorded for a pop crossover album that never quite materialized. Released posthumously, first on the Selena film soundtrack and later on her greatest hits compilation, the thumping tune shimmers with disco elements. It would fit in perfectly between spins of Donna Summer's Hot Stuff and Blondie's Heart of Glass during a 70s record night. For an album benefiting the AIDS Project Los Angeles, Selena recorded a driving, club-ready version of A Boy Like That, a song about falling in love with the wrong boy that originated in West Side Story, a musical created by four gay men that has long been regarded as a subliminally queer work. But it's not just Selena's music that has long resonated with queer fans. A whole generation of queer people born after Selena's time know her outfits by rote. The famous white dress she wore at the Grammys and in the video for No Me Queda Más. The newsboy cap getup emulated by drag queens. The bolero jacket. The one that stands out most to me is that spangled purple jumpsuit she wore during her last televised concert, which is on display at the Selena Museum in Corpus Christi. Her sparkling ensemble was both playful and dazzling. I wanted to wear one just like it. When we were still getting to know one another, I told my first boyfriend about the ecstatic moment when I met Selena in 1994 at Rio Fest in Harlingen. At the meet and greet that day, my little gay heart leaped for joy at the first sight of her toothy smile under the embroidered cap that bore her name. She gave me a hug and asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. 10-year-old me, an astronomer. From then on, I was a dedicated fan. I borrowed all my cousin's cassettes and watched a local TV program, Puro Tejano, on which she often sang and danced. My elder cousin teased out her hair and applied as much makeup as she could to resemble Selena. My younger cousin lent me Entre a Mi Mundo, and I spent months playing the tape over and over, awed by the nimble keyboard underpinnings of Selena's Tejano tracks. I became determined to learn to dance the cumbia on my own. I eventually taught my first boyfriend how to dance the cumbia, barefoot, in the first house we shared, on a desolate stretch of asphalt overlooking the sands of South Padre Island. During the 8 years I was in love with this athletic, tanned beach boy, he came to learn that if he were to love me, he would have to love Selena, too. Our experience of queer love began with Dreaming of You and evolved as we absorbed her other albums together. As was the case for so many queer Texans, we came to see versions of our stories in hers, brilliantly transfigured, free to love grandly, and emboldened to cross over the river of self-doubt. Harlingen native Joe Galvan is a writer, artist, and anthropologist living in Portland, Oregon.
And we've come to our time where we must sign off for this week's program. We'll continue with the articles Linda has read in next week's broadcast from the April 2021 edition of Texas Monthly. And we'll also read articles from TM's archives from the 1990s that were written during Selena's busy career. Thank you for being with us. We hope you'll join us again next week.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear Recording Library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Life Center has scheduled a fundraiser dinner featuring speaker Benjamin Watson, former NFL player, author, speaker, and philanthropist. 6:30 p.m., April 27th, at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Conference Center. Table sponsorships and individual tickets are available by calling 432-683-6072.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we continue our series of Oscar-winning films. Saturday, we present the 2012 film awarded Best Picture, Argo.
Actions of Iran have shocked the civilized world.
Our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages.
If we're going to go, then we need to go now.
We've got Revolutionary Guards going door to door.
It's
going
to take a
a miracle to get them out.
They're a Canadian film crew for a science fiction movie.
I fly into Tehran. We all fly out together as a film
this
crew.
This is the best bad idea we have, sir.
You have 72 hours to get them out.
You really believe your little story is going to make a difference when there's a gun to our heads?
I think my little story is the only thing between you and a gun to your head.
The 2012 winner for Best Picture, Argo, audio described, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 63 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S., as well as in the UK, grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world, and from coast to coast on public university and community radio stations, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Make-Believe Ballroom. And thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band music, and many of the stories behind the records and the personalities who recorded them. Hope you're all doing well. I have an interesting show planned today, and in the spirit of the topic, I want to play an audio clip that I've played in the past that I always found interesting about the mindset of big band musicians and vocalists of the era. The clip features Bee Wayne, that spent many years with the Larry Clinton Orchestra as their vocalist. Let's take a listen.
Helen O'Connell, my dear late friend, who sang with Jimmy Dorsey, big star, told me once that she was being interviewed, like I'm talking to you now, and the interviewer said, "Do you realize that you were making history then?" And she said, "If we knew we were making history, we would have paid more attention." Because evidently now, and looking back, over the big band time, it was historical. The music was historical, and it's still a marvelous time.
But you didn't think of it at all in that term.
No, we were just kids working, making a small amount of money, and singing. That's what we wanted to do.
If we knew we were making history, we would have paid closer attention. Little did the bands at that time know that their music and history would ultimately stand the test of time for many decades to come, right up until today.
So I want to discuss an event that took place in New York City that history little remembers, with very little written about it or orally recorded. What was that event? No, not the Benny Goodman Carnegie Hall concert of January the 16th, 1938, which obviously has been well documented in the music history books, but an event that took place later in that year, in 1938. I'm going to keep the suspense going a little while longer and play Larry Clinton with B. Wayne, because they were there, allegedly, in 1938. I Double Dare You, recorded on the Victor label that same year. Downing Stadium, which started its life as Triborough Stadium, was a 22,000-seat venue in New York City that was built under the Triborough Bridge on Randall's Island. The stadium opened on July the 11th, 1936, and what an opening it was, as the 15,000 fans in attendance witnessed the great athlete Jesse Owens compete at the stadium in the men's Olympic trials. And Owens won both the 100 and 200 meter track events. And that ultimately ended up with him competing in the Olympics that summer in Berlin, where he won gold. And to much of the delight of the free world, threw it in the face of Adolf Hitler. Now to the music history, which took place on May 29th, 1938. Over 22,000 big band and swing fans were in attendance for a little remembered event called the Carnival of Swing. I'm going to tell you a lot more about the carnival as we weave our way through what is really little known We do know who was on the roster that played or probably played. So on today's show, we attempt to recreate that event with some of the bands who were there and probably some of the music they played for the ticket holders. So all 1938 all the time on today's Make Believe Ballroom. Chick Webb and his orchestra were on the flyer for the acts that were going to appear at the Carnival of Swing. So here's Chick with Wanton Rhythm, played on a radio broadcast in that very year, 1938. ¶¶